This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome into another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. Today, a conversation with Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Nerona on the latest in the Jamal Gonsalves investigation. All right. So obviously, in the midst of COVID and even a presidential election for that matter, the big story here in Rhode Island for many people has been the incident involving 24-year-old Jamal Gonsalves and the Providence Police Department. Mr. Gonsalves was on a moped last Sunday as part of a group of, some accounts, up to 300 riders who were going through several municipalities. And Mr. Gonsalves was separated from that group and in one way or another pursued by Providence Police. And that resulted in the situation that probably most of you are familiar with. Mr. Gonsalves is now in a coma at Rhode Island Hospital. And just today, his family said that he's still in that situation, although he was able to respond to his parents and squeeze their hand. He's still in serious trouble, medically speaking, and it could take several months for him to recover. So right now, this investigation, where it's at, is kind of twofold. You may have seen some of the live streams that I've brought you from inside the Providence Public Safety Complex as Mayor Alorza, Commissioner Parry, Chief Clements, Attorney General Nerona, and State Police Colonel James Manny have sort of laid out the procedures for what's happening. And in a nutshell, there are kind of two things happening. One, there's a criminal investigation that is taking place under the direction of Attorney General Nerona, who you'll hear from in a matter of moments right here on B-Town. There's also going to be the procedural element of whether or not the police pursuing Mr. Gonsalves was appropriate per the policies and procedures of the Providence Police Department with respect to pursuits and chases. So yesterday, Providence Police released the body cam footage worn by the officers involved, and it didn't reveal necessarily any new concrete details in the matter. What we did learn from this is that following Mr. Gonsalves' crash, officers administered Narcan and they maneuvered Mr. Gonsalves, even attempting to take his helmet off at one point. So that was revealed in the body cam footage. Besides that, the investigation ongoing, and again, you're going to hear in a couple of moments exactly what that means from the Attorney General's perspective and what the mechanics are of that investigation. Yesterday, also, Jamal's family held a press conference, which I was at, and I asked them, are you comfortable with where the Attorney General's investigation is, with where Providence Police is on this? And they said, as of right now, things are in motion. They asked for people to remain patient as they are remaining patient with this, but that there are lots of facts that need to come out. They also indicated that there are eyewitnesses to this incident that will come forward and will provide information that can sort of help to shape a better narrative of what actually transpired. But obviously, this is an extremely horrible situation. Now, we've also brought you much of the protest that has taken place as a result of this all last week, live streaming those and reporting on those. And you've seen it. Members of this community here in Providence and the state at large, just extremely frustrated by this incident and out in the streets. It did devolve into a riot on Tuesday night outside of the Providence Public Safety Complex. And then on Wednesday, the marchers tried to make their way into the city of Cranston, nearby the site of the incident, which is literally on the Cranston-Providence border off Elmwood Avenue. They were stopped by a group of Cranston police, along with state police, Warwick police, and Providence police, and several were arrested there. There was some tear gas that was deployed as well. And another bit of a chaotic situation. And then last Friday, a much more peaceful protest, no arrest. And the marchers did try to get onto Federal Hill, or they were on Federal Hill. They tried to get onto Atwells Avenue. They were blockaded by Providence Police. But all in all, you get the sense that this is not going away and that people are hungry for answers. And so hopefully today, Attorney General Nerona can offer some perspective into where his office sits in this matter and how, again, mechanically it's going to play out. So we're going to hear that in a matter of moments. And as always, appreciate your listening. We're in the midst of a week of daily podcasts, mostly focused on the election, but had to bring this to you as well. This is definitely the hot button issue here in the state of Rhode Island and beyond, again, even in the thick of COVID and the election. Okay, let's get right to it. Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Nerona, the latest on the Jamal Gonsalves investigation. Can you kind of give us a look inside at some level of where this investigation is right now, the process that you're taking in being called upon by Mayor Elorza to act as that independent arbiter?
Yeah, look, I think to step back, I think it's important to talk about what it is that we're doing. Okay, so whenever there is a serious incident involving a police officer from any department around the state, including the state police, you know, our office, when there's any potential of criminal liability whatsoever, and sometimes sometimes in criminal cases, you know, a crime has occurred and you just have to figure out which crime it is and who should be charged with it. Other times you're not sure if a crime has occurred and you have to investigate it. And you don't know. And those two kinds of things come up all the time. But whenever there's an incident involving a police officer, you know, they discharge their firearm, they use deadly force, there's an allegation that they use excessive force, they're chasing somebody to try to apprehend them on foot or in a vehicle, and injury occurs, then what's called our Attorney General's use of force protocol comes into play. And what that means is that three entities, if you will, are going to be involved in that investigation. It's going to be this office, as the office that ultimately makes every criminal charging felony decision in the state. Police can charge a felony case initially in district court, but it cannot become a perfected, charged, for lack of a better word, real felony case unless my office signs off on it. So my office is involved in that to analyze whether or not criminal liability may exist. To help us with that, to question witnesses, to track down video, in a case like the one we're talking about, to do accident reconstruction, I don't have those investigators to do that work here in the office, so I need someone to help. If it's if the agency that's involved, meaning their officers involved in the incident, if they're my, if you will, investigative arm, my boot on the ground arm, there can be an allegation that they're not, you know, asking all the right questions, or they're not finding all the video. So the way we address that is to have a third party in, and that's the state police. Now, if it's the state police that's involved in the incident, let's say it's a trooper whose conduct is in question or needs to be evaluated, then the city or town where the incident occurs, Warwick, Providence, Jamestown, would be that other set of eyes. So it's really a team concept. You know, the lawyers kind of guide in many ways the direction of where we're going. They make sure that all the questions are asked of witnesses, say, to make sure that we can analyze it under the relevant law. They're really there to oversee the investigation, but the boots on the ground investigators, the experts, say, to do traffic reconstruction, are the involved agency, in case we're talking about Providence, and the state police as that set of independent boot on the ground eyes. But it really is a team effort. And we do that routinely around the state. It happens all the time. So that's how the process works. So where are we? Where are we was your other question in the context of this investigation. So where we are is we're doing that boots on the ground investigating. So what does that mean? That means doing a accident reconstruction, Providence and the state police. That's a complicated process. You do a lot of measurements. You do a lot of photographs. There are some 3D applications that come into play here. And they really do try to reconstruct what happened in this particular incident. Now, that's a technology or a process that we use all the time. You know, we'll see on the weekends. It seems like it happens a lot on the weekends. Happened again this weekend. Well, there'll be a fatal accident on the highway or fatal incident on a highway. A lot of times, you know, we are all witnesses to those events. And we have to reconstruct what happened. Was speed involved? Was reckless driving involved? Was texting involved? And reconstructing how the accident occurred, was alcohol involved, can really give you some of those answers. So accident reconstruction is not something that isn't used very often. In fact, it's used quite frequently. And there are people here in the state that do just that and do it incredibly well, particularly state police, because they are on the highways doing this kind of work quite a bit. So we have that piece that we need to address. The other thing that we need to do is make sure we have the accounts of everyone who saw it with their own eyes, you know, not through some video, but actually saw it themselves. And that involves some work. It's going through, you know, so for example, I watched the body cam footage for the first time yesterday, just before we presented it to the family so that they could see it before the public could see it, you know, yesterday, Sunday afternoon. And so you look on that videotape or that body cam footage, and you'll see, you know, a balcony with three or four people on it overlooking, you know, the scene. And so the question that I had then, and the investigators will track down, is, look, did you canvas the neighborhood? Did you walk through that neighborhood and ask everybody then and afterwards, did you see what happened? So there's that piece of it, getting firsthand, I saw it, witness accounts, seeing whether they line up, seeing whether they conflict. And if they conflict, try to understand why they do. And then the third piece, I would say, is getting every last bit of video. And so some of that was the video that the public has already seen. One was, I believe, shot by a civilian bystander. One was from a surveillance camera down one of the streets at that intersection. And then there's the body cam footage from those officers who had their body cams rolling in the aftermath or just leading up to this incident, all of which has been displayed publicly. So what's left, we want to make sure that's all the video. And then what we'll do here is pull all of that evidence together the way we would in any case and analyze it and then see what, if anything, should be done from a criminal perspective. What we don't do, Bill, is engage in sort of a review of the Providence Police's conduct from an administrative point of view. So that, you know, PARA has come up a few times in the context of this matter already, and PARA has a role under the city ordinances of Providence. But we're state prosecutors, and what the city of Providence does in terms of how they oversee their police department is really a matter for them to, A, in the first instance, decide and then operate. So PARA has a role, but it's not a role that is part of my world. My world is the criminal investigative process. And once we've either ruled in crimes or ruled them out, then it can proceed, in my judgment, to the next step, which is, you know, whether that be a civil case that might be brought by, you know, on the part of a plaintiff, whether that be some kind of, you know, administrative action that may or may not be taken. It's just not something I judge or get involved in, where PARA might have a role. That's really beyond what we do. What we do is analyze the situation for whether there's any potential criminal liability, and if there is, what that liability is, and then what do we do with it? You know, how do we present it, you know, to a fact finder at some point? But we're a long way from getting there yet, simply because there's a lot of investigative work that remains to be done.
Has your office seen any footage that the public, by and large, hasn't seen yet? Anything other than what's out there now?
I have not. I have not seen a piece of footage that the public has not seen.
And I think back to, I think it was earlier this year that you, your office, sitting in the conference room and at the Attorney General's headquarters, if you will, in Providence, and that process of bringing in an agency from the outside to assist in the review of possible criminal misconduct. So that's what we're talking about. A new policy essentially under your administration that is in place in terms of review of situations of possible police misconduct. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, that's right, Bill. I mean, what we did was we expanded the old protocol. So the old protocol was really limited to deadly force cases. So cases where a police officer discharged their firearm and shot or killed, you know, a civilian. Now that could be in the context of that could be a legitimate use of deadly force, but we needed to review that. Or when they fired their firearm and didn't strike a civilian, we would still review that under that protocol. What the protocol did was expand that review process to include, most significantly in my judgment, misdemeanor conduct. So if you're a police officer and you assault somebody in your custody, so I'm not talking about using force to bring someone into custody. That happens. Not everybody who needs to be arrested goes there willingly. But when a police officer allegedly steps over that line, so you know, you can think of a case where the person might be in the cell block already and the officer strikes them, or they might be in the back of the cruiser and the officer strikes them allegedly. Those are cases that would typically be misdemeanor assaults. And in our state, misdemeanor assaults, like all misdemeanors, are prosecuted by the local city and town solicitors. So in Providence, it's their city solicitor. In Barrington, it's their city attorney. We only do misdemeanors when they are brought by the state police. So what this protocol did was we swept in those misdemeanors that involve police officers' alleged use of excessive force, even when they're misdemeanors. And I did that because I felt like this office has the expertise and has the independence, and frankly, has a continuity of operations to do those very, very important cases that the public cares about, that I care about, that police officers care about really well. City solicitors do a good job. And by saying that, I don't mean to say otherwise. But the reality is that there are 38 of them, I guess, and because leave Exeter out, there are 38 of them. And so they may all apply different standards. They may apply different sentencing recommendations. They turn over from time to time as political leadership changes, so there may not be that continuity or experience or perspective over the years. And I thought these cases were so important that our input was value added. So I decided to take that step.
Support the independent journalism, opinion, analysis, and entertainment that B-Town has become known for by becoming a B-Town insider. Head over to patreon.com/BartholomewTown or click the support link where you're listening right now. We're now about just over a week into this incident. I believe it was Commissioner Parry that said this will be about a two-week investigative process. Does that sound about right? Should the public still be expecting some sort of updates in a week from now?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I don't want to speak for the commissioner. I think he said that the traffic reconstruction would take a couple of weeks. I think that's probably right. Mm-hmm. I think it will really depend on the extent to which our folks can make sure that we have interviewed all the witnesses adequately for our purposes. You know, and so why is that important? For us to make a analysis as to what this conduct is in the context of potential criminal liability, whether it is or isn't, I don't know. We have to make sure that we have all those witnesses and they've answered all our questions. You know, if we can get access to witnesses quickly and they give forthcoming answers quickly and we're confident in those answers, it could go very quickly. If, on the other hand, there's conflicting testimony or someone refuses to meet with us to give a statement, or I have real questions about the account that we're giving, it might take a little bit longer. You know, it's entirely possible. It's too early to say whether we would present this case to a grand jury or not. You know, but the grand jury is a powerful investigative tool that allows us to get evidence that we can't get otherwise. So what do I mean by that? I'll give you a very specific example. I'm not saying it's happened in this instance. But let's say we couldn't get we thought there was somebody who saw something, but for whatever reason would not tell us what they saw. Well, I just want to know what they saw. It doesn't matter what it is. I just want to know what they saw. If they're an eyewitness, we need to know that. How can we measure this case unless we know what they saw? Now, hopefully they would eventually agree to give a statement to the investigative team. But if they didn't, then I could use the grand jury to bring them in, you know, force them to come in and testify under oath in front of a grand jury. So I hope that that's not the case. I really don't want to use the grand jury unless I have to as an investigative tool, because we've talked about this a lot before. It really starts to cloak this investigation in secrecy or non-transparency that I recognize can be problematic, particularly in cases like this. So I'm really trying to avoid that if I can. It's just too soon to know whether we'll have to use it or not.
This incident has certainly sparked protest. It sparked a lot of dialogue and conversation. What is your office doing to monitor, I guess, the protests, if anything, that are happening right now? And then also possible outside agitators. There was a truck, a white truck, that approached and sort of drove through. It didn't run anyone over, but potentially could have a group of protesters on Friday night. And there are reports that that individual is someone who's been described as an agitator in the past. Is that something that's on your radar screen and kind of part of this package of this overall conversation here?
Yeah, look, you know, there's, you know, I'd be living in a different state of reality if I wasn't aware of what was going on around us. And I've always been very concerned, long before these days of 2020, about community law enforcement trust. It's why we've done a lot of the outreach that we've done. Some of the expungement clinics we did were not only to help people, but to try to build community trust. In fact, I met the father of Jamal at an expungement clinic where he was helping out in his role as working for a nonprofit, helping us facilitate one of our expungement clinics last year. And so it was great to make that contact that, you know, the first time we met, you know, he obviously, I feel badly for him and the family and Jamal, but at least I'd met him before. You know, these are difficult conversations to have. And so that's why we do the outreach. You don't know that it's going to play out that way, but that's just the way it happened to play out here. So I'm always conscious of that and very concerned about it. You know, I think protests, frankly, I've always loved our state and our country's instinct to protest when we think something is wrong. I've said this before. When I was U.S. attorney, I could look out my window and see folks protesting on the steps of the courthouse, federal courthouse. I didn't always understand or know what the issue was. Couldn't quite see the signs really from my vantage point sometimes. But I always appreciated and admired their willingness to stand and speak out loudly for the causes that matter to them. You know, I think protest is important to our democracy, and I think it's a great thing. It has to be peaceful. you know, it can't devolve into violence. You know, certainly, you know, it can't devolve into, you know, throwing things at police. Police also have to use restraint in dealing with protesters. You know, that's a really volatile place where we are right now. You see it, you know, I follow, you know, when I know there are protests, I follow it through some of your reporting, some of your fellow folks who are out there kind of, you know, recording in real time. I follow it because I want to know and need to know what's going on. And I see how volatile it is. And there is a potential there for people to get hurt. And then sorting it out afterwards. You know, look, you know, when I was a trial prosecutor, the hardest case to prove was sort of the barroom brawl that took place either in the barroom or in the parking lot. In a scene of chaos, it's oftentimes very difficult to sort out, you know, who the bad actors are. So the more chaos, the more difficult it is to try to find justice. And so when it devolves in this way, a lot of conduct that might be held to account in other circumstances kind of gets lost in the chaos, unfortunately. So there's that. You know, when it comes to people who are taking advantage of the situation we're in, this community law enforcement lack of trust, and are taking advantage of the vast majority of protesters who just want their voices to be heard, to engage in provocative action towards other protesters, in particular, I'm very concerned about that. And so as we get reports, and I don't want to get into specifics, but as we get reports from people from any side that may be a potential threat or maybe trying to exploit a situation to sort of bring their own ideology into the mix, then we're very concerned about that. You know, we have lots of ways of getting that information. People can reach out to us, me sometimes directly. They'll reach out to the state police. We get it out to the Fusion Center and the state police, and they'll follow up on it. So the reality for those who would agitate, I guess, is this, that there are lots of people recording them. One thing, when you watch these protests, is everybody has a camera out. Sometimes it's media like you. Sometimes it's just an everyday, you know, member of the public. The odds of us seeing that video are pretty high. And if you're engaged in activity, which is all concerning, we're going to follow up on it. And in certain instances, we have. The role of this office is to try to get this right. And we are, and I've said this a number of times, that there's a tension there between getting it right and doing it fast. And we can't do it fast at the expense of getting it right. But I also recognize that the public is looking for answers very quickly. What I can say is that, you know, I put my best people on these cases. I stay involved myself. And I do that because I want to get it right. And so that is really our objective. The other thing that we're really trying to do here is to let the family know that when they need to reach out to this office, we are available for a conversation. But I hope that's the message that they've gotten from the two meetings we've had. And we're just going to continue to work this case and get the answers that we need to make the right legal conclusions that we have to make. And that can only be our compass, is to understand the law, understand the facts, and use our best legal judgment, bring our experience to bear, try to get it right.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill. Good to see you as always.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
For daily content, give me a follow on Twitter and Instagram at Bill Bartholomew.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.